This is the podcast for Physics 2710, Introduction to Modern Physics, and the date is 27th of February, 2007. No questions, Jacob?
Not that I can think of.
So tell me about the hydrogen atom.
I'm sure I have a lot.
Okay, we'll start chapter 7.
Oh, wait, we're still in 6? Wait.
Go to hydrogen atom here.
Do you recognize this potential energy term right here? It says the potential, but it's actually a potential energy. Because it's E squared. It's got both Q's in there. What potential is this? What is this the energy of?
Point charge.
Okay. Since it's a potential energy, it's the energy of a system. How did we say this in our other class? Q1, Q2 over R. And this is different from the force in that it's not R squared. Okay, this is the potential energy, and what we didn't emphasize, but we can now, is that it's a function of R, that's the variable down there, and we also wanted it to be, let's see, we put a negative sign in there, because, no, we don't want the negative sign in there yet, but we do know what K is, it's 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught. Now if we plug in the Q's, what we're looking at is a hydrogen atom, so one of the Q's is a proton, and the other Q is an electron. So for our specific case now, we end up with the thing on the computer screen, that is the electron is negative, so that's where that came from. There's the K, 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught. And now once we take the negative out of this, both of these have the same magnitude of charge, and it is E. We still have that same R. So that's the letter V now is the one this book uses. So that's where, foreshadowing here, notice that this function is symmetric, radially symmetric, that when you think of three space, X, Y, and Z, that there's no preferred direction and this is symmetric all the way around. And so you can really just use one variable, R, to talk about the distance from the origin rather than worrying about X, Y, and Z independently. And you know that R is equal to the square root of x squared plus y squared plus z squared, but it does mean that you don't have to worry about those individually, just R. For this potential, that's only because it's a spherically symmetric potential that we can say that. It's this particular case. It might not be in other cases. In fact, it isn't. If you have a cubical box finite potential well or something, then they might have different dimensions.
Look at the bottom of page 222. Let's go back to the elbow because I don't have it on those notes. We'll just look at it on the book.
Okay, there's the potential that we just looked at. And if we plug it in to the Schrodinger equation, it's going to go in right there. That's going to go in right there. This part should look familiar. It's the three-dimensional version of it, but this is the time independence, so we don't have the derivative with respect to time. If you go back and look in the earlier chapters, I guess it even tells us which one. Equation 643, this is the three-dimensional because we have the partial with respect to x and y and z. It's the second order derivative, though, second partial, with respect to each of those. And we could write that with the Laplacian operator. But the trick now is to simply take this general Schrodinger equation, three-dimensional, time-independent, and plug this potential in, because that's what says this is due to a point positive charge. This is the proton, the nucleus, the center of the hydrogen atom, and then the electrons running around. And then what's it going to look like? And that will tell us the specific case. Then we get to the next equation, 7.3 in your book, but it's also back on the computer screen. Transform the three Cartesian coordinates to the spherical coordinates, and you end up with this. We are looking for a three-dimensional wave function. Oh, by the way, why is there no T here? Why is it not four-dimensional? Because we're not having the hydrogen atom zip across space, or at least we're not worrying about that. If you have a hydrogen atom just sitting there, the potential well produced by that proton in the center is just sitting there. It's just stationary, and it's not evolving in time. It's not changing, you know, and Tuesdays, it's not different than it was on Mondays. So it's independent of time. The potential well looks like the potential well that we know and love from a point charge, and it just sits there. So that's why there's no time derivatives, because there's no change with respect to time so we use the time-independent version. But the trick, then, is to take this equation, which we had on the screen in Cartesian coordinates, and do this transformation from xyz to r theta phi, and arrive at this same equation, only expressed in spherical coordinates, rather than Cartesian coordinates. That turns out to be quite a trick, does it not, Teresa?
Well, I couldn't do it.
We have thrown down the gauntlet, and Miles' little mathematical squirrels are churning in his brain.
What?
And he has decided to take on the challenge.
What challenge?
Right, equation 7.2.
I just believed him.
Into spherical coordinates.
Oh, that was easy.
Well, I worked on it for 20 pages last year, and it didn't quite ever fall together completely. I got huge portions of it, and I got really close. But it was never to where I was satisfied with it after 20 pages.
So if I do it, can I get an A?
Yes, absolutely. You can even get an A if you don't do it, as long as you get really good on all the homework, quizzes, and tests. Would it help you get an A? Is that the question?
Would I be guaranteed?
I'd be very impressed. I'd have to smile kindly.
Just a math question. How does that, you know, I mean, so R equals, you know, all the transformation equations down there, how do you plug them into a differential equation?
Well, that's the trick. If you want me to look for my 20 pages that I did last year, I could look for them. But the Laplacian operator looks like this in spherical coordinates. I think in that little wave essay I wrote for you about the wave equation, I briefly make mention that if there's no dependence on the two angles, if it's totally spherically symmetric, then look what happens. If there's no dependence on theta and no dependence on phi, then those terms just totally drop out. That one's gone, and that one's gone. And all you have left are, you know, that thing right there. Now, this is not the wave equation. This is not the classical wave equation. This is the Schrodinger equation. But the same type of idea would apply even to the classical wave equation. If there's no dependence on theta and phi, and you just have one term, and that I can do. But it's these other terms that really made it quite hairy. These are the substitutions you want to make. That is to say, if you go back to the original equation at the bottom of page 222, which is in Cartesian coordinates, the Laplacian in x, y, z, and then substitute in for every x you see, you put in all this stuff. For every y you see, you put in all this stuff, etc. And take all the appropriate derivatives, and you have to use the product rule, and this and that and the other. It gets to be quite hairy, but you're supposed to end up with this thing here. And Marty Lynn says she just believed them at some level. I do too, but you have to satisfy your curiosity sometimes too. And I didn't get it to where I was happy with it. I got most of the way. I got plausible arguments. I got to the point where you say, "Ah, you can kind of see how it's going to," but it was never rigorous. And I might just be really rusty. Teresa's a math teacher and Miles is a math major. Maybe the two of them can make it happen.
You've had a lot more math than I've ever had.
Well,
yes, I'm sorry to tell you this, but I spend a lot of time trying to get kids to just understand what a function is, let alone, that's where my mind is.
Well, if I could find those 20 pages, I'd be happy to show you what I did, but it's kind of interesting, I don't know if you're curious, but the reason that Teresa has tried all this and that we're having this conversation is it's one of your homework problems. You're supposed to do this. And she wrote back and said, "I tried. I couldn't do it." And that's when I told her that I couldn't either. So you're off the hook for that homework problem, except I wanted you to try. So I didn't tell you all when I told her, hoping that you'd at least give it a stab. Because it's, which problem is it, Teresa?
It's four. It's the first one.
7.1. Chapter 7, problem 4 or something like that. You're supposed to do this. And that tells you it ought to be doable if it's like at the beginning of the homework set.
Beginning?
Who were the authors of this book that tells us we should just forget about homework for
the solutions manual has a couple of lines in it, which I did not bring up here, but I could show you. But it wasn't helpful because they skipped all kinds of steps. I'd be happy to show you what the solutions manual has.
Yeah, well, I mean, I looked up in a lot of different things, and I tried doing sort of the approach with geometry, you know, try to figure out, okay, what would this be, taking it, you know, just the basic geometry of it, and I got all tangled up in a big mess.
Yeah.
That's when you're brand new.
Yeah.
Remember your trig functions and trig identities.
Well, let's assume that it can be done, and the reason that we want to do it is that we don't consider the problem to be an XYZ type of symmetry problem. It seems to be more of a spherical, or at least a spherical coordinate-oriented problem. For those who have had Calc 3, you may notice that many, many math books label the two angles in the opposite way from many, many physics books. Did I say that right? Math and physics do it backwards. So lots of spherical coordinate people will call this the phi coordinate and this the theta coordinate.
Confusing.
I know.
Wait, that is how math is, isn't it?
I think, I can't remember, it's been too long, but
I think it does do it from the...
If you're thinking of spherical coordinates as kind of a generalization of planar polar coordinates in the XY plane, then you have an R vector in the plane, and the angle is usually theta in the XY plane.
Oh.
If you're thinking of a generalization from polar coordinates,
I thought,
then you'd use the new variable, the phi variable, as how far down from the z-axis. I think if I were doing it, I probably would label that theta and that phi, but it's done both ways, and these notes are taken from someone who has followed our book. Our book has the same picture in it, page 223, so figure 7-1. So that's how they label them. Okay, pay attention to the color here. These notes I like for a lot of reasons. They're easy to read, you know, it's got the highlights and it's kind of a good thing to talk about and uses talking points. But I also like the color, just generic purple for X, Y, and Z, because we're going to leave those behind. But now look, when we're going to concentrate on this equation in R, theta, and phi, we're going to use the color to keep everything straight that way. And it really kind of helps organize where we're going with this. Remember, this is the equation that we think describes things in nature, quantum mechanically, matter waves and stuff like that. So we'd like to know what the electron is going to do around a hydrogen atom, around a nucleus, a proton. And this is going to tell us, if we plug this in for this potential energy function right here, we have a differential equation. It's second order in space. It was first order in time, but we're even ignoring that now. And it means that the solution to the differential equation is a function. We're after a function. This is the wave function. None of this is new that I'm saying right now. We've done this for now a couple of chapters. But I want you to keep this really clear and straighten your heads as we go. We're now applying this idea of finding a function that satisfies the differential equation to the particular case of a hydrogen atom where we plug in the potential well due to a proton in the center, and we see what the electron's then going to do around that proton. So we're after phi, and phi is going to be a function of R and possibly theta and phi as well if it's not totally symmetrical around the sphere. Is it separable? Well, if you've had differential equations, you know that if things are separable, this is always good, and it makes life bearable. But it isn't always true, and you don't necessarily know if an equation, differential equation, oops, going the wrong way, is separable or not. Is this separable into the different variables? Can we write this phi as a product of a function of R, another function of theta, and a third function of phi? And, you know, we probably wouldn't be talking about this if it didn't turn out that we could, but how are you supposed to know this ahead of time? Well, what you do is you postulate that it can be done, and you write it down that way. You say, we're after the phi. This is the solution to the differential equations. This is what we want to know. Let's assume that it's a product of a function of R, another function of theta, and another function of phi. And now we're going to plug this back into the Schrodinger equation and see if it satisfies it. So everywhere we see a phi, we're now going to plug in R, F, G, product. R, F, G, R, F, G. And take those derivatives. We'll take the derivative of RFG with respect to R, the derivative of RFG with respect to theta, and then, of course, have to do it again, etc. And see if it works. And see what kind of boundary conditions apply There's another argument we have to switch over to the Elmo a bit for, because they skip some stuff in these notes. The derivatives that we need are these. We need the derivative of this function with respect to r so that we can plug it in right here. We need the derivative of phi with respect to theta so that we can plug it in right here. And we need the derivative with respect to phi so that we can plug it in right here. Now this is the Schrodinger equation in the spherical coordinate form. And now we're going to plug in r, big R, you know, the r function of little r, times f times g. And then it says if we multiply everything by this factor right here, just to simplify everything, r squared sine squared times r of g, and rearrange a few terms. And so they've skipped some steps even here in the book a little bit. But you now arrive at this version of the Schrodinger equation, the differential equation. Notice there's no size left anymore, no wave function size. They've all been substituted for parts of the r or f or g function. If you're going to take the derivative of the function with respect to r, you only have to take the derivative of big R, because f and g don't have any r's in them. So if you're going to take the derivative with respect to r, you drop all those. And you actually have to do it twice here, once inside the parentheses and then once here too. And let's see, likewise over here, if we're going to take the derivative of the function psi with respect to theta, we don't have to worry about r and g because they don't have any thetas in them. So all we have to do is take the derivative of f with respect to theta for that part and get there. And a similar argument can be made down here. Now the notes here in the next paragraph say, look closely at this equation and notice the two sides of the equation. This equation 7.7. Here's the equal sign right here. Get something a little sharper to point with. Okay. The equal sign's right here. And notice on the left side, which is the above stuff, there are no phis whatsoever at all, anywhere. No phis at all. On the right side, which is this little tiny piece over here, there are no r's or thetas. So we have already achieved a separation of variables in the sense that we've been able to get the terms on different sides of the equation that relate to different variables. And the same argument we made in the last chapter applies here as well. For a function of some variables to be always equal to a function of a totally different variable, that is to say, you can alter r or theta all you want to, and you can also alter phi all you want to, for this to always be equal, how could you possibly arrange that? You can change r to your heart's content, you can change phi to your heart's content, sine theta. You can change these things here to 10. The only way these can always be equal is if they are, both sides, equal to a constant. Do you remember this trick we did before? Now, they might be equal for a particular value of r, and a particular value of theta, and a particular value of phi, without making this claim. But we're making a much stronger claim. We're making the claim that no matter what r is, and no matter what theta is, and no matter what phi is, these are always, the two sides are always equal to each other. And the only way that can be is if both sides of the equation are equal to a constant. I hope that feels good, because this is the second time we've seen that little trick, that technique, and it's very lovely right here. What constant is it going to be equal to? So we're going to set the right side equal to a constant, and that constant is going to be a negative, well, once you multiply both sides by g, go down to the next version, equation 7.8. All we did was multiply g up over here. We have a negative constant, because m squared is always positive, or zero, and that makes it non-positive. This is a differential equation that we have seen before. We're looking for a function g whose second derivative is proportional to the negative of itself. What functions do you know of whose second derivative is a constant times, or a negative constant times, the function itself? It's the third time we've seen this one. What functions satisfy this?
Sine or cosine?
Sines and cosines. This is the harmonic oscillator function, or differential equation. Okay? This is Hooke's law with Newton's second law. Second derivative proportional to a negative constant times the function itself. G is what you're looking for. Sines and cosines satisfy that equation. Now, remember about the coordinate system. G, now we can get both on the screen. G is the function of phi, and phi is this variable right here. And as you can see at the bottom, they call that the azimuthal angle. Think of this as like longitude, if you're thinking of spherical coordinates on the surface of the Earth. This is the angle away from Greenwich, England. So the solution in this direction, the phi direction, to the Schrodinger equation for hydrogen atom, the solutions are sines and cosines. Because we're able to separate variables, separate the differential equation, and set up both sides equal to a constant. And when we did that, we got our favorite old harmonic oscillator equation that we know the solutions for already, sines and cosines. Questions so far?
Is it bad if we didn't read this section because at the beginning it said it's too hard and we can't skip it?
This is a pretty tough section, and that's why I'm taking time to go through it, but it would be a whole lot better if you had read it.
I would have, had I not read that first paragraph.
Oh, it scared you away.
Yeah. I thought this was bad enough.
Are you understanding as we go through it now?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we set one side of this separated equation equal to a constant. We said for this to be true, both sides have to be equal to the same constant. So that's the next task. Take the left side of this equation and set it equal to the same thing. Negative m sub l squared. Why we call it negative m sub l squared will become apparent soon. So don't fret. We could have temporarily called it k or something like that if we had wanted to. But there's a reason why we did it this way. We've done that here. Let's see. This is both the R version and the theta version from the old left side, but they've already set it equal to negative ML squared and rearranged it already. So they've already done some work to get here. There's the ML squared piece right there. It's in that term. But notice that they've also done some other stuff here with a goal in mind. They want to separate again because the original left side still had two variables in it. It had both R and theta in it. And now we've accomplished a second separation of variables. The left side of this new equation, this is 7.9, the left side of it has only R stuff in it. There are no thetas on the left side of the equation. The right side of this differential equation has no R's in it and has only thetas. And so you make exactly the same argument again, which we just barely made. This would be now the third time we've ever done this. If two sides of a differential equation like this, which are dependent on totally different variables, are always equal to each other, the only way that can happen is if they're each equal to a constant. Now, they know this really well, the authors of our book, so they know what to choose for that constant. Again, you could call it K sub 2 or C sub 2, whatever your favorite letter for a constant is. You could do that temporarily, but you'd eventually have to realize that the boundary conditions are going to impose some things on this. And the authors already know this ahead of time. So they go ahead and set both sides equal to a kind of a clever, pre-known constant that they know is going to help us out. And that is this right here, L times L plus 1. Both sides of this separated equation now have to equal L times L plus 1. And if you do that, rearrange a little more, you get this equation. If you take this one and set it equal, still got the M sub L in here. That hasn't gone away. We still got that from the earlier separation of variables. Take this, though, and set it equal to L times L plus 1, and rearrange a little bit, and you get this equation, 7.11.
Maybe that's why he skipped it in his notes, is because it said... Do you know what I'm talking about?
No.
The very first paragraph says a couple sections in this chapter, sections 7.2 and 7.6, are advanced topics, and maybe skip without losing...
Oh, so you read the rest of the chapter, just not those two sections.
Yeah.
Oh, I get it. I get it. Well, I consider you to be advanced students.
That's why we understand it. No, that's okay.
Here they are color-coded. This is the azimuthal equation pertaining to the variable phi, which is the azimuthal angle. This is the radial equation pertaining to the variable r, which is the radius away from the origin of your coordinate system and spherical coordinates. Big R is the function of little r, which is the variable. I hope that was always clear all along. And then this third one, we also got by setting equal to L times L plus 1. See, there's that little blue piece right there. That's the same thing that you get right here from the second separation of variables. This is the theta equation. This is called the angular equation, and this is the angle down from the z-axis. That's what theta is, as you recall from our diagram. We now have three second-order ordinary differential equations. They're no longer partial differential equations because there's only one variable in each. Cool? Do we like ordinary differential equations or partial differential equations better?
Ordinary.
We like them both.
We love them both because of their beauty and intrinsic worth. However, which are easiest to deal with? Oh, yes. The ordinary differential equations are sometimes tractable. Partial differential equations are almost always hard.
We still love them.
We still love them.
Okay.
What do you propose we do with these differential equations?
Solve them.
Yes! Yes! We want G, we want R, and we want F. And when we get those, we will then multiply them together and have what, Jacob?
The pitchfork.
Is that what we call it now? We'll have the wave function, psi.
Did you just come up with that?
It's also Poseidon's trident. R times F times G will be psi. And we will know what the wave function looks like, and we will know if we square it, or more precisely, if we do psi star times psi and take the integral of that, then we will know the probability distribution of the electron around a hydrogen atom. Isn't this exciting? I mean, this is where we want to go. We want to find out where the electron's going to be. If we can find the answers, the solutions to these three ordinary differential equations, each solution is a function of its own. G is a function of phi, R is a function of R, F is a function of theta. If we can get those, multiply them together, we will know what the hydrogen atom looks like quantum mechanically. And you your chairs, I mean, this is really pretty exciting stuff.
I think we talked about this kind of in my chemistry class in high school. And we had a paper, and it had, like, rings in it, and you tried to drop your pencil on the middle ring, but the probability would most likely, like, end up in the second ring.
Oh.
So it's, like, the exact same thing. We should
do
that. We should drop our pencils on paper.
You're right. There's a mechanical the universe, they talk about that, too. Well.
I'm not joking.
If you're aiming for the middle,
but you miss.
The angular equation, this is the blue one down here that has theta as the variable and F is the function we seek. Angular equation, here we go, is the associated Legendre equation. The associated Legendre equation has as solutions, that is to say, if you go to a standard ordinary differential equations textbook, you may find a differential equation in there called, I mean, these are famous. They're famous because they're useful and they've been studied for a couple hundred years, and they usually get named after the person who first either wrote it down and or solved it and figured out what the solution would be. So a guy named Legendre writes down this differential equation because it describes something physically. This is way before quantum mechanics. And solved it and says, guess what? The solutions to this angular equation, this one right here, the solutions to this differential equation are Legendre polynomials. Do you remember the solutions to the Schrodinger equation for a harmonic oscillator potential, that is a parabolic potential well?
No.
Okay, let's go back even further. Do you remember our solutions for a infinite potential well, square?
Kind of. But I don't dare say because it's probably wrong. Wasn't it sine and cosine? And
yeah.
Then in the middle and then outside nothing?
Right. For an infinite potential well, square well, we had sines and cosines inside the well, and because it was infinitely tall, there was no potential, no tunneling, no leaking out. It was just like strings from last semester. It was just like waves on a string, standing waves. In fact, we were able to even eliminate the cosines because they didn't come to zero at the boundaries like we wanted. Didn't match the boundary conditions. So only the sines worked and with those boundary conditions. Then when we relaxed the infinite well and made it a finite well, we had sines still inside, but then we had decaying exponentials in the... these were all solutions to the differential equation, right? Schrodinger's equation gave us those functions. We didn't just invent them. We didn't just say, oh, I like sines a lot today. I think that's what's going to be inside the well. It was because sines and cosines satisfied the differential equation, given that potential. Given the V, the function of X that we had, those were the solutions. And when we had a finite potential well and it leaked into the walls with the decaying exponential, that also came from the differential equation. We solved it, had a different sign on that term, and so it produced exponentials instead of sines and cosines. But sines and cosines are exponentials too in their own way, but they just have a different sign on them. We made the comment that we've kind of used up all of our favorite functions. We love sines and cosines because we know and understand them. We can take the derivatives till the cows come home. They're all easy.
And we even don't mind exponentials. They're easy to take derivatives of, too. So in the cases that we studied, it's almost as if the physics god smiled down upon us and said, the easiest conceptual physical conditions would be a square well. Let's, you know, God said, let's have that be a nice, easy solution for those poor students. And then the finite potential well, that's the next simplest case, you know, the next most complicated way to consider things. And the solutions weren't too bad then either. We can deal with sines and cosines and then decaying exponentials. But you can see a progression. We've used up the easy functions. We've got to invent some harder functions. The next potential well we did was the, well, we did the cubical box, but other than that was the parabolic potential well, which we call the harmonic oscillator, the quantum mechanical harmonic oscillator. The solutions are not sines, and the solutions are not exponentials. Those are the solutions to the other potentials. They can't be the solutions to all the potentials. Sines and cosines were the solutions to the square box. Exponentials were the solutions in the walls, the decaying exponentials. So what were the solutions to the parabolic potential well if it wasn't sines and cosines and exponentials?
Those weird functions.
Yeah, it was. What are they called?
Something that starts with an H.
That's correct.
I don't remember it after that.
Hermite polynomials, which are orthogonal polynomials. You can build up functions out of these polynomials using them as kind of basis vectors in linear algebra terminology. And those Hermite polynomials describe the wave function in the various excited states in a harmonic oscillator potential well. Okay? Is that a good review? Does that help?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, what's the potential well now? It's not a square box, either infinite or finite, and it's not a parabola. What's the potential well now?
It's the
The contour lines would be circles. What, Teresa?
Like a sphere?
It's due to a sphere. It's spherically symmetric, yes. But the mathematical function is a hyperbola. It's a 1 over r functional dependence, right? It's not a parabola. It's not a square. It's a hyperbola. Think of your potential well going down, or going up, I guess, due to a positive charge.
It makes sense now, because that's what the equation of V was.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine that.
Yeah. Okay. What are the solutions going to be? Well, they're not going to be sines and cosines, except we're lucky and one of them is. And they're not going to be decaying exponentials, and they're not going to be Hermite polynomials. This is a different differential equation. Why is it different? Because the V term is different. The rest of Schrodinger's equation didn't change in the time-independent version. The rest of the equation still has all the terms it had in the previous cases back in chapter 5 and 6. What makes this equation different is the V is different. It's Schrodinger's equation, but it's Schrodinger's equation for a particular case, namely a spherically symmetric point charge potential well, which is hyperbolic. It's got the 1 over r in there. That's what we plugged in for V. That dictates what the rest of the solutions are going to be like. That V, even though it's only one term in the whole equation and all the rest is the same, that V alters everything. And when it's a hyperbolic point charge potential well, we get what we're getting. And notice that we lucked out and got sines and cosines for the azimuthal solutions. But we're not going to be so lucky for the other variables, for the other two separated ordinary differential equations. For the azimuthal equation, the green one up here, we got sines and cosines because that's the simple harmonic oscillator differential equation. By the way, just for interest's sake, just so you'll understand this point I'm trying to make, that the math is in some sense, at some level, independent of the physics, we will see a very, 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 very similar equation to this green one when we do AC circuits in regular physics. And the solutions will be sines and cosines. There'll be different letters in there for the variables. It won't be G, and it won't be called phi, and the constant will be called something else. But the form of the equation is exactly the same. And so the solutions are going to be the same kinds of functions with appropriate scaling factors and constants and normalizing things. It's all okay, but it's the same equation. Now, the one at the bottom, the blue one, the angular equation, is called the Legendre, associative Legendre equation. And it's been studied for 200 years, long before Schrodinger wrote down his wave equation. So we know what the solutions to this blue equation are. It's an ordinary differential equation in one variable,
And we know what the solutions are. The functions F that satisfy this are called the Legendre polynomials. Somewhat similar in spirit to the Hermite polynomials, but they're different because it's a different potential. Is this all making sense? Am I just being too heavy-handed and just beating the ugly head with this until you're saying, gee, we get it, Larry, we get it?
No, it looks, I mean, like in the top equation, the second one down, the radial equation, you still just got a V written in there. How is it different? In, I mean, it just says V in there. You didn't put your E squared over whatever in there or anything, so why does it make, why does having a different V make it so different?
Put it in the next one.
Well, let me answer that a couple of ways.
Maybe I'm just not following it through careful enough.
Let me answer that a couple of ways, except that we're not to the radial equation. We're doing the blue one first. But when we get to the radial equation, we will plug in the V right there where you say. We will do that. And we will find out what the solutions to that are. But the comment I should make even before that is even before we substitute in the point charge potential, well, due to the proton, for this V right here, I'm going the wrong way, yeah. Even before we plug that in, this is no longer the original Schrodinger equation.
No, yeah, I mean it's
the form of this differential equation is quite different from what we started with after we did two procedures of separation of variables. This red stuff by itself is no longer the Schrodinger equation in its entirety. And so even though we haven't even plugged in the V yet, we still don't necessarily expect to get the same solutions we got before, because this isn't the same equation we had before. But you're absolutely right. They did write V right there instead of minus 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught E squared over R. But we will do that shortly when we examine this equation in detail.
That's the only one you can put in there, right?
What?
That's the only V that you can put in there, right?
That's the only V you can put in there for
hydrogen atom.
For a hydrogen atom. But let's examine the blue equation first. It's the angular equation, and like I say, if you're really good at differential equations, I mean, much better than I am, you might be able, possibly, I mean, this would be better than me, you just look at this and you say, oh yeah, I recognize the form of that equation. That's the associated Legendre differential equation. You know, people could do that. Not me, but somebody could. I recognize that. That's the associated Legendre equation. And in fact, Legendre figured out the solutions to this 200 years ago. And in fact, Abramowitz and Stegen have tabulated these. And who knows? I bet you even Maple probably knows about the associated Legendre differential equation and its solutions. And to the very same page that I turned the other day when I showed you the Hermite polynomials, do you remember these guys? These are the solutions to the simple harmonic oscillator, the quantum harmonic oscillator. On the same page, if I just slide it over, guess what you get? The Legendre polynomials, and they look a little wilder than the Hermite ones. They're exuberant polynomials. Those are the Legendre polynomials. Those are the solutions to the associated Legendre equation that is also known in our context as the angular equation. That's the equation in theta whose solution is the function f. Notice that there's not only one of them. There's many of these. There's lots and lots of them because these are quantized, and we're going to be able to plug in various values for the quantum numbers and use the different polynomials for the different wave functions. We're not going to arrive at one single wave function for the electron in the hydrogen atom. We're going to arrive at gazillions of them based on what boundary conditions we plug in for the energy and stuff like that. We'll have lots of them, like we did for the harmonic oscillator, these guys, okay? So the Legendre polynomials are the solutions to the angular equation. Here's a chapter in this book on Legendre polynomials. And here's another picture of them. This looks quite similar to the one I just showed you. And if you'd like to see them tabulated, what are the equations or formulas for those polynomials? They're right here. And they're kind of fun because they're not really very intimidating. They're really actually kind of simple. Aren't those reasonable?
Those look a lot more reasonable.
Those aren't too shabby. In fact, You can even maybe see some of these in the picture, although you're looking for maybe that one and that one as straight lines, and you don't see them in the picture because they didn't draw a piece of 0 and piece of 1 because they're too easy. Piece of 0 would just be right there. Piece of 1 would just be right there. They start with P3. There's P2 and P3, P4, P5. But that's them. Okay? Now remember, these are the angular equations. These are the ones that are the from the z-axis angle, the theta angle down from the z-axis. The solutions to that part of Schrödinger's equation are given by these Legendre polynomials. Okay. Now maybe I don't want to shut that yet. I might need that again. It turns out that if you take the solutions to f and g, these solutions, these things we just talked about, these are the angular equation theta things, the Legendre polynomials. G we talked about earlier. These are sines and cosines from the simple harmonic oscillator differential equation that we first saw in the computer. This was the green equation and this was the blue equation. It's customary to multiply those two together because those are both of the angular dependences. They want to separate out the R solution because that's fundamentally kind of different from the angle solutions. The stuff that depends on the angle is kind of different than the stuff that depends on the distance. And so they multiply these two together traditionally, and they call them spherical harmonics. And because Marty Lynn has not read her email today, she did not get my list of websites that talk all about spherical harmonics. Some good websites, go watch those, and they're usually labeled with this Y thing. Here are the spherical harmonics. Notice what you
see.
These are the product of those two things we just talked about. You see sines and cosines in there. That came from the G function. And you see the other polynomial type stuff in there. That comes from the Legendre polynomials. And these are normalized, so the constants out front look a little different than we saw before because these have been integrated to find out what the constant front really ought to be. These are the normalized spherical harmonics for various values of what? L and M sub L. What are these? Where did we get these things? Well, they turn out in your chemistry class to be quantum numbers. For all we've talked about them so far, these are the constants we sent both sides of the differential equation equal to. Remember M sub L? We said negative M sub L squared was the constant when we first separated variables. And then the second time we did it, we set both sides of the equation equal to L times L plus 1. Well, this is the L, and it means something physically. Like I told you, these guys knew where they were going from the beginning. So they didn't use a temporary variable. They went straight to what it's going to be at the end. This is related to the angular momentum of the electron. And this is called the magnetic quantum number because, well, we'll see why. But they tabulate various values of L and M sub L and see what the corresponding spherical harmonic is. That is to say, if you can zoom in even a little more here and see what this, you can see that Y has subscripts L and M sub L because those two things determine what the actual particular spherical harmonic will be. Depends on what L is and what M sub L is. And so they're tabulated like this. Any questions about the green equation? G, which gave us sines and cosines, or the blue equation, the angular equation of theta that gave us the Legendre polynomials, or their product, which are called the spherical harmonics. Any questions about that? Let me ask you a question. Do you think it would be possible for a computer to maybe plot these functions? Mm-hmm. Yeah, you should say yes to this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Piece of cake.
And so all you'd have to do, if it was had a good user interface, it would say, what would you like L to be? What would you like M sub L to be? And then it would draw you a nice picture of the resulting wave function. Okay? Now remember, we started off today by not being sure that we would even get away with this strategy. We said we'd try separation of variables. We would assume that psi is a function of R, is a product of three separate functions, one of R, one of theta, one of phi. We weren't sure it was going to work, though, because separation of variables doesn't always work. But so far, it seems to be working. And, you know, the end from the beginning, it does work, or we wouldn't have gone this far down this blind alley. So we've figured out the solutions to two of the three separated parts. It's now time to return to the computer and the red equation. Let's see what's going on there. The radial equation, that's a function of little r. We're looking for big R, which is the function of little r. There are those little things right there called quantum numbers. Here's the radial equation. If you were a really good differential equation person, you might look at this differential equation, which is in form different from this one. Notice that square right there is different. There's not a squared right there, and the square on the R right there is different. There's not a square on the sine theta down there. So the form of these two equations are different, but somebody really, really good might look at this and say, ah, yes, I recognize my old friend, the associated Legendre equation right there. And if they're that good, they might also look at the red one and say, ah, yes, I recognize that as the associated Laguerre equation. Ah, yes, that's the Laguerre differential equation, named after the guy who wrote it down and figured out the solutions a couple of hundred years ago. The Laguerre differential equation is going to have as its solutions Laguerre polynomials.
They are different.
You
can't read the name, you just kind of say L.
Oh, you just thought they were the same? The L guys? Well, Laguerre and Legendre are different. Probably both French, but on the same page that we first tabulated the Hermite. Here's the Hermite polynomials again. Third time we've seen those. These are the solutions to the quantum harmonic oscillator. Today we've now seen that the Legendre polynomials, the solutions to the angular equation, are these guys, and we've even seen what they form, the equations look like. And on the same page are the solutions to the Laguerre differential equation. These are Laguerre polynomials. And they can be tabulated too. Here's the differential equation. If we took the time, and I'm not inclined to, but if we took the time, we should be able to match up piece by piece all of this stuff to the red equation that I've been showing you, the radial equation, say, yeah, that, you know, the X was the R, and et cetera, et cetera, and it's all there. So it's the same equation, the same form. So the solutions are the same. The solutions to this are Laguerre polynomials, so the solutions to the radial equation are the Laguerre polynomials also. Do I have them tabulated? There's a picture of the Laguerre polynomials. First couple of them, three of them, L0, L1, L2. Notice that they're different. The Legendre polynomial P0 was 0, and L0 is 1. P1 was x, which goes like this, and L1 is a linear one that goes down like that. In fact, here are they tabulated. And they're another set of orthogonal functions in the linear algebra sense. In fact, in this book here, all of these, all on this whole page here, they're in a chapter called orthogonal polynomials. So these are various kinds. We haven't yet scratched the surface. There are this many differential equations that people have found solutions to, and you can tabulate all the different polynomials and look at them. It's just kind of fun that the three we were interested in all turned out to be on the same page. That was neat. The ground state solution. That is to say, we want the lowest solution. There are many, many solutions based on these quantum numbers, n sub l and l, which can take on various integer values, but we want to know about the lowest one to make this easiest. In fact, if you go back up to here, we don't want to worry about that term. So if we set L equal to 0, then that goes away. That means we don't get all of the radial functions out of this. We only get the ground state if we do that, but that's the one we're interested in first. So that term's gone. It was right over in here. This is a simpler differential equation, and notice that V is still written as V, but Teresa reminds us that the whole point of this is that this is a hydrogen atom, and this is the potential well for a hydrogen atom. So that has to be plugged in for V as well. And it is a function of little r. And the fact this is a function of little r means a whole bunch here. Insert a trial solution. So this is a function of little r, r of r. Let's assume that it's a decaying exponential thing like this. Well, plug stuff in. Put this back in everywhere you see a big R. So put it in right there. And put it in right there. Take the appropriate derivatives, see what the boundary conditions tell you and the other constants, and it turns out that this really does work as long as you have this constant in the denominator equal to all this junk. 4 pi epsilon naught, we know where that came from. H bar squared we've seen before, previous context, that's Planck's constant. mass of the electron, and then the charge there. Now, if you plug all this stuff in for the energy of this lowest ground state solution to the radial equation, remember that we're assuming that m sub l is 0 and l is 0. We're only getting the ground state solution. But if you do, and you plug all this stuff in for a naught, and you really do the values, really plug in the numbers from the inside cover of your book, guess what number you get? Does anybody recognize this number?
Of course.
What is it, Miles? You of all people ought to know this number.
It's 13.6.
It's the ground state of energy of the hydrogen atom.
You learned this in chemistry.
I should. Never had chemistry.
Never had chemistry?
No.
We didn't do that. We just dropped pencils on the paper.
Teresa, did you see this number in chemistry?
I think so. It's the first ionization energy or something for an ionization deal.
That's correct. Let's make sure we tie those two comments together. This is the ground state energy of the hydrogen atom, which means, and it's negative Y. What does a negative energy mean, Jacob?
Good question.
Remember in class a couple of days ago we talked about the potential energy when you multiply the Q1 times the Q2. You might get a positive sign or a negative sign. What does it mean when the potential energy is positive versus when? Well, that's how you get it, but what does it mean physically? What's the consequence of it being positive or negative?
I guess, like, the negative potential energy usually relates to a restoring force.
Okay. And if the kinetic energy, which is positive, isn't too much, so that the total energy is negative, negative potential energy, maybe a little kinetic energy too, but if the total's negative, what does that mean? Like it does here. This is a negative total energy, negative E.
As you get farther away, it gets slower?
Yes.
Kinetic energy. That's not what you
mean. I'm looking for a word that starts with B. Should we play amen?
Let's do it. Starts with B?
Starts with B.
Oh, yes.
Marty Lynn, first letter?
Oh.
Teresa, you get next letter.
That's right.
I don't know what you're going for.
Guess a letter.
That's the fun of hangman.
I don't know.
There's only 24 left to choose from.
I don't. A.
Just like Home of Fortune, you want R S T L N E.
R. Let's see, we put the bad ones up here. A didn't work. R didn't work. Jacob?
E?
Oh, that was Martin. You guys both took me. I didn't want anything.
I know.
Miles, your turn.
N. Yes.
Marty Lynn, back to you.
Boing.
Boing?
I
hope you never forget this word after we do
bound.
This.
Oh, I like boing better.
Negative energy means it's a bound state.
Oh, okay.
If you want it unbound, you have to add in how much energy?
Enough to make it positive.
Enough to not have it be negative anymore. You have to add in 13.6 electron volts of energy to make this system not bound anymore. And the word that Teresa used for that was? Yeah. You ionized the hydrogen atom, which means you've separated the two parts of the system out to infinity by making the energy equal to zero or maybe more if they have kinetic energy, by adding in 13.6 electron volts of energy to get it out of its negative bound state. Now, playing hangman was a waste if you don't remember this.
You can remember it now.
Ever.
I'm boing.
You have to remember this forever and ever. Negative energies, negative system energies, means it's a bound state. And it's bound by 13.6. It's going to take 13.6 electron volts of energy to pull them apart. Okay? And that's experimentally proven. We know that this is the case from experiment. We knew it was 13.6 electron volts before we solved the equation. So we're really, really grateful that the solution to this differential equation gave us something that we'd already measured. The energy of this ground state system is negative 13.6 eV. And we breathe a huge sigh of relief because we already knew that. The other interesting thing is this thing right here that we said had to be the constant in here. Remember another little trick I taught you in the other class? You can't take trig functions or exponential functions of anything with dimensions, anything with physical units. So if R comes in, what are the SI units of R?
Meters.
Meters. No. Then A naught has to come in.
Meters.
Meters also, because they have to cancel out, because you can't take the exponential of anything with units. So it has to be E to a unitless thing. So A and R have to have the same units here. And so that means the units of all this stuff have to be meters. And you can check it out and make sure that it really is the case, and it will be. But that's also significant. How many meters will it be? Well, not very many. 10 to the minus 10th something approximately. And guess what? It turns out to be another number we already knew. Remember, Schrodinger's doing his wave mechanics in the 20s. And Bohr had already had his model. Remember Bohr's model of the hydrogen atom back in the teens? And Bohr already told us what the radius of the ground state would be. And it's A naught. And what are we saying here now? That we get the same number out of the solution to Schrodinger's wave equation. The same number, the Bohr radius, pops out. This is pretty sweet. I mean, you're supposed to be really impressed by this. Higher order solutions, that means that we don't have to always assume that this is zero and this is zero. If we want other solutions besides the ground state solution, we can do the more complicated version, which is right here. We can plug other values of L and M sub L into these equations and get the higher ones, the higher states. Again, we already talked about the Laguerre functions. It turns out there's a quantum number that pops out of these that's N, the principal quantum number. You've heard about this in chemistry. The main point that I want to make here in Chapter 7, I'll probably repeat it many times because I'm always so impressed by it myself. The main point is that everything you learned in chemistry, and I mean just about everything, is a result of solving the Schrodinger equation. Now, so far, we have only done the simplest possible atom we can think of. A hydrogen atom isn't very complicated. It's just got the one proton and the one electron. But if you could solve the Schrodinger equation for more complicated potential wells of higher chemical elements or molecules, you'd know all of chemistry. That is to say that the physics really does come out of the mathematics. And this is totally shocking to me, because math can be done in a brain, it can be done with pencil and paper, it can be done in a disconnected way from the real world. You don't have to have an application in mind or a physical reality or a system to attach your math to. You can do math in its own world, its own sphere, its own brain land, totally divorced of physical reality. And if you go off and play in mathematical brain land, you might invent things like the associated Laguerre differential equation or Hermite's equation. And you might even be able to solve that differential equation just on pencil and paper, just as a mathematical exercise. And isn't it just absolutely amazing that it means something, and that it does apply, and that the Schrodinger wave equation gives you those, and they become part of the separated equation, and those solutions really produce measurable things, some of which we knew about before Schrodinger from the Bohr model, other things of which we'll find out later Bohr didn't know about, but also turn out to be experimentally true. This equation, I should say the solutions to this equation, the size that we get, really do describe the hydrogen atom. So these spherical harmonics, who would have dreamed up these cosine sine business multiplied by these polynomials would have anything in reality? Well, they do. The shape of the hydrogen atom is dictated by the Schrodinger wave equation, the potential well we put in it, and the boundary conditions we impose. And we get all of chemistry out of this. We really do. To me, this is very, very amazing. Every time I think about it, it's amazing. Why does math have anything to do with the real world? But it does. And if you have a computer model these equations and their solutions and draw the spherical harmonics like you said we could make a computer do, that's exactly what the hydrogen atom looks like. And so if you'll go look at the websites I sent you about the harmonic spherical harmonics, you'll see some funny-looking mathematical shapes in 3D. And those are the shape of the orbitals of electrons around atoms, dictated by the solutions to these differential equations. Now, it's not very exciting for principal quantum number n equals 1. The lowest state isn't particularly exciting. But if you put in higher n's and also allow these to be non-zero, you get some very interesting solutions that aren't spherically symmetric. And you don't just use the radial equation, which only talks about r, and you'd think it'd be totally symmetric. There are dependencies on theta and phi when you let these be non-zero. And that means the shape of these wave functions are not spherical shapes anymore. And when you've talked in your chemistry class about SPDF orbitals, guess where they came from? The solutions to Schrödinger's equation imposed by the boundary conditions. The SPDF orbitals you can arrive at without even thinking about chemistry or atoms or Schrödinger. If you just did a purely mathematical exercise and solved this differential equation, you would get those dumbbell-shaped things and the donut-shaped things that you've seen in your chemistry class. You would get those in your graphing calculator program as a purely mathematical exercise. And yet they describe the true shape of the wave function of electrons around atoms. Just amazing. Just totally amazing. The energy levels scale with n squared, but you knew that from chemistry too. And Bohr. Bohr also said that. Here's some notes on the spherical harmonics that I didn't. Here's a little bit more on those quantum numbers and what values they can take on. N is an integer, a non-negative integer. L can't be any bigger than N. It has to be less than N. So L can be 0 up to the next one below N. And these are not just arbitrary things we decided, oh, let's make sure that L is always less than N. These are also imposed by the boundary conditions and the solutions to the differential equations. None of this was up to us once we arrived at the differential equation with the potential in there, with the V for the proton, the hyperbolic potential well stuck in there. Once we did that, all of this was determined. There's no choice left anymore. It has to be this way. And the M sub L's, these magnetic quantum numbers, can have negative integer values. They can go from negative L up to positive L. And you'll see this kind of scheme on one of those websites as well. Here's some of those pictures in these nodes. You know, like the P orbitals. You've heard about that in chemistry, right? D orbitals, have you seen these in your chemistry books? These shapes are the shapes of the orbitals, but it's because they came out of the Schrödinger wave equation. They're the solutions based on what values you let M sub L and L be. Yeah, S stands for sharp, P stands for principal, D stands for diffuse, F stands for what, fine?
Fundamental.
Fundamental, and then they just went in alphabetical order after that. Anyway.
I thought maybe I can remember those. I guess they're a little bit smart.
Do these quantum numbers have any relation to the, like the Rydberg equation, how it's based on the n's on the bottom, the n and the m?
Rydberg's equation was the generalization of the Balmer equation, which predicted the spectrum of hydrogen and the different Balmer passion series of the lines. And then Bohr was able to explain that in his model fairly well. He was able to explain the Rydberg equation too, based on his stationary states and his circular orbits. What we're saying now is the orbits are not necessarily circular. The L equals zero orbits are circular. That is to say, those SPDF things correspond to L values. For S, that means it's a code. It's the same thing as saying L equals zero. And whenever you say a P orbital, it's the same thing as saying L equals one. For all of the L equals zero orbitals, you know, regardless of what N is, whether N's one, two, three, or four, there's always going to be an L equals zero substate of that, and that's always spherical. But the others are not spherical. So we depart from the Bohr model here, Jacob, by saying that these other orbitals, other than the L equals zero ones, are non-spherical. But nonetheless, that A sub zero, the Bohr radius, is predicted as the most probable distance away from the atom, even with the Schrödinger wave equation and the probabilities and all that stuff factored in, it does reduce back to the Bohr radius for that distance. And so the Rydberg equation is also explained by this too, and we'll get the spectrum out of this, which is what the Rydberg equation is attempting to quantify. We can predict all those spectral lines from this stuff too. The energy differences, you know, gives the photons out. It's all going to be part of this. You get going. Okay, well, finish reading chapter 7 for next time. You've got a test tonight or tomorrow night. I guess you won't get them back till next week since we don't have class for 5 days.